Good afternoon. It is 12:30. This is In Studio with Kevin. We are live here on CKMS 102.7, available live on radiowaterloo.ca/listen and live on Facebook at MyAudioFace and at CKMS. Very pleased to welcome Dr. Suzanne Kearns from the University of Waterloo. Hello, hey. Suzanne.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. I'm so glad you were able to join me today. We already started a spirited chat earlier, so we'll have to remember which parts to bring up again. But I could already tell we're going to have a great conversation. And when I write up the little summaries for the shows to make a description, it turns out I always write multiple versions because I'll start writing with always a little bit of a humor in the back of my mind, because I always just think I'm the funniest thing in the world. So I want to make like a little pun or some, you know, witty little comment. And then when I'm doing that, I go, but nobody else reading this has any idea what I'm thinking. They'll just think it's either dumb or it doesn't make any sense. So I rewrite it. Every time I do that, and certainly case in point with yourself, is there's so much. And it's like, okay, how do I, in just a few words, how do I describe the person or what we're going to talk about? So I stuck to things like aviation and teaching, academia, advancing women in the industry. But there's probably so much more. So I'm not sure where we want to start. How about introduce yourself and tell us a bit about you?
Absolutely. So my name is Dr. Suzanne Kearns. I've been a professor in the aviation program at the University of Waterloo for the past 2 years. But previously, I was with the aviation program at the University of Western Ontario for 12 years. So I always lived in KW, so I was commuting back and forth to London.
For the whole 12 years?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, that I did not know. I knew you were at Western.
But yeah.
Was that a little bit over an hour each way?
It is. And then parking at university is challenging. So it's a little over an hour plus 10 or 15 minutes to actually get into the building you need to get to.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So I started flying. I was one of those kids who every time I looked up and saw a plane overhead, I'd say, I'm going to do that one day. And then my parents, amazingly now, because I have my own kids and have a hard time putting myself in their shoes, but they would just say, well, if you want to do it, just go ahead and do it. And so when I was 15, they signed me up for my first ground school, and so I was sitting in with people, of course, actual real adults. I was still a child, and I ended up soloing an aircraft on my 16th birthday, which at the time was the youngest you could be. And then I finished all my license requirements, but you had to be 17, and I wasn't 17 yet. So when I was 16, over the summer, I'm from Wyarton, Ontario, but my parents arranged for me to live out of a hangar out of Buttonville Airport in Toronto for the summer of my 16th year, and I flew helicopters. So I got all of my training done for my private helicopter pilot license. And at the same time, I was learning to drive, so I'd fly helicopters, and then young drivers of Canada would come pick me up, and I'd go do driving lessons to drive a car.
So you were flying helicopters when you were 16.
Yes.
Of course, before you were old enough to drive cars.
Yes.
That's amazing. So did you actually... Yeah, so you had your license by then?
Well, you have to be, at that time you had to be 17 to have a license. So when I turned 17 on my birthday, I had my private airplane and helicopter pilot licenses signed off when I was old enough.
And had you gotten your driver's license by then as well, or was that still...
I don't remember. I think so. I obviously have my driver's license now, but it didn't seem to make as big of an impact. Although I will share, you'll think this is funny. So I thought I was so excited about this, and the news came out, and they videotaped me flying a helicopter on my 17th birthday, and I was so excited to be on the news. So I went home with my whole family, and we're watching it, and they did the little story, and then at the end, the commentator said, wow, flying helicopters and still wearing braces. What do you think about that?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So my ego went from big down to really small.
I guess I was there. See, it's those commentators trying to be funny. They're just sticking to the good stuff. That's amazing. I actually did... I can relate to the ground school piece. I never got my license, but I had a friend in final year of high school who was... He wanted to be a pilot, so similar age, and I'm not sure why in hindsight, but he said, why don't you come take the course with me? And I'm like, okay. Yeah. So I did ground school, which is very intense. It's not really something you just go and do, but I did that, and I did maybe 8 hours of flying at of just, you know, single engine planes with an instructor. So I never, you know, flew solo. I don't even think I landed. I know I took off and flew it. I don't know if I ever did a landing by myself.
Okay.
If I did, I don't think. I'm pretty sure I'd remember, because I still, I didn't do it enough to ever get any sense of confidence that, like, this is going to be a safe idea to give me a license. but the fellow I did it with, he continued on his way and, you know, still works in the industry, and he got every license and went on his path. But it is an amazing, it's an amazing journey. And to think you did that. And then helicopters, which is, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's fairly different. Like,
if you
fly a plane and you get into a helicopter, would a pilot have any idea what they're doing or no?
The instruments are the same. Talking on the radio is the same, but the actual hands and feet of flying is very different. And so it's more expensive to fly helicopters. So the hourly rate can be 3 times as much as an airplane.
Oh my.
So that's a challenge, of course, but there's nothing about like the freedom of flying a helicopter, because airplanes are very much airport to airport, of course, because sure. you need a runway. But helicopters, you could literally look out on the landscape and you can choose anywhere to go. So that level of freedom is an amazing feeling. It certainly sucked me in. And so after I got my private license, it's funny now because I made the strategic decision to not do my OAC, so grade 13. I did not have academic aspirations.
Okay.
If you told me then I'd be a professor, I would have said you were crazy. And so I went to Canada College in North Bay, and they have a really great helicopter program, which includes all sorts of really fun things like long lining, where they take the doors off the helicopter and they attach like a 50-foot line to the belly, and then it reaches down to the bottom and they would attach logs and you sort of transport logs back and forth. But you do the whole time you're flying by leaning your head out the window and looking straight down. They also taught us things like I had my chainsaw operator certificate, so you can cut down trees and build log pads in the bush, so you could create your own landing sites.
Oh my goodness!
That was on my resume for like 20 years because
that's pretty cool. The first person I've met has that. I've never known that. So you would need to actually build a landing pad. Depending on where you are.
A lot of helicopter operations in Canada are in northern areas. And so that's one of the draws that a lot of people, if you love that lifestyle, I think it's a really neat way to live. For me, it was a challenge because I didn't realize that a lot of those camps where they operate out of, they don't have multiple spots for different genders. So they don't have like separate showers or bathrooms. And so it's a little more challenging for a woman in that role. Mm-hmm. So like when I finished that, I was looking for a university degree because I wanted to I had a college diploma I wanted to build up. And at that time, there weren't any university aviation programs in Canada for pilots. Okay. There were college programs, but I'd already gotten a college diploma. And so I looked to the States, and the States actually has a really long history of university degrees. And the way I kind of explain it to people is that in the States, there's a strong military heritage in aviation.
Yes.
And to be a pilot in the military, you have to be an officer, which requires a university degree.
Oh,
so there was a need for a lot of them. So I ended up going to a school called Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. It's in Daytona Beach, Florida.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I officially had more relatives coming out of the woodwork to visit me in Daytona. Yeah. Nobody visited me when I was in North Bay.
That's all. Yeah. I don't think it had anything to do with
the location. Don't
take it personally. No. Okay. And then so you got your degree there and then moved back to Canada after that?
Yeah, so right around the end of that degree, I interned with an airline, and I had jump seat privileges for the first time. So all pilots have jump seat privileges for their airline, and basically in the cockpit, there's the captain and first officer at the controls, and then in a lot of aircraft, there's a third seat that folds down, and so it allows pilots to kind of ride to commute to wherever they need to go.
Okay.
So when I did my internship, it was an unpaid internship, but the real carrot that they gave us was we had jump seat privileges. So I was 21, and I got to sort of travel all over the place on the weekends. And during that time, a lot of things kind of happened all at the same time. Like I love aviation. I still do. But I never really understood the lifestyle. I've had a hard time with being away. And of course, you think, well, you should have known being a pilot, you're going to be away from home. But I didn't really know what that was like. And I found like I was missing paying bills. And you know, just didn't feel situated in my life. And so, you know, a lot of things happened. I ended up having a really hard discussion with my parents saying like, I don't think I want to be a pilot for the rest of my life. And and of course, that's a really big turning point. But I ended up going back to Embry-Riddle and I did my master's in human factors. Human factors is the science that underlies basically why people make mistakes. So it's one of my teaching areas, one of my specializations from a research perspective.
So human factors is not specific to aviation.
Nope.
It's a field that, can you describe it again?
Yeah, so it kind of draws from a lot of other fields. So there's some psychology, some physiology, some ergonomics. So basically what we look at is how a person's mind and body works and what those limitations are and how those limitations can lead to errors in their professional environments. So in the piloting world, it can be everything from fatigue to becoming distracted or overwhelmed, to interpersonal communication, so not speaking and working effectively together as a team. But human factors applies to things like also surgeons, like surgical theaters, where you have the surgeon, anesthesiologist, and nurse, and they all have to work and communicate. That's a very similar environment to a cockpit, the teamwork needed.
Sure.
Human factors also applies to technology, so human-computer interaction and making things usable and intuitive. It's the same field as well.
Okay, but you in turn, so you did your master's in human factors and then apply that basically to aviation.
Yeah, well, I did it at an aviation university, so it was very situated in aviation. Mm-hmm. And then I came to Canada at that point and was kind of hunting around and trying to find a job. And while I was in the States, the first aviation degree program had started at Western.
Okay.
And so I sent a resume in and they hired me as a professor. So
you were you the first professor or one of the first professors to teach at a university level in Canada?
I was the first aviation professor. They because I think not having university level aviation like the States has, that it doesn't produce, you know, people at the master's and doctoral level. Like we didn't have as many. And so I think Western had been kind of hunting for somebody with at least a master's degree who'd be interested in academia. So I was only 24 at the time. Like I was young, and they took a chance on me, and I still have nothing but respect and appreciation for them doing that, because even myself, if you had asked me, do you want to be an academic for the rest of your life, that I feel like academia is an expertise in and of itself, just like aviation is an expertise or piloting is an expertise. And so moving to become a professor, there's a lot to learn. There's a big learning curve. And a lot of professors, they start that learning curve early. Like they know from maybe their bachelor's degree or at least through their master's that that's where they're headed.
Okay.
And so they set themselves up for that profession. And I didn't have that vision in my mind. So I had a lot to learn.
So you literally completed your master's and then basically said, okay, maybe I'm going to go this professor route.
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing. And I'm trying to picture 24 years old, you already have flown helicopters, flown airplanes, you're a professor teaching human factors at Western.
Yeah.
That's incredible. And then so you were there for a dozen years.
Yeah.
And do you teach the same course at UW now?
Yeah, so I have four classes. So I teach a first year introduction to aviation. That's the one my new textbook is linked to. I teach a third year human factors and fourth year safety. Human factors and safety kind of go together, but they're similar but not exactly the same. And I just this past semester taught a new course on sustainability, which was a new area for me, but it's...
Sustainability as in environmental sustainability?
Yeah, so from an aviation perspective, so it's about looking at the balance between the economics, the people, and the environmental protection, and trying to find a way that sort of accomplishes those three things without sacrificing any.
So how would that apply in a practical sense?
So if you think about aviation, so maybe it's easiest to look at from a navigation perspective. So the way that airlines get from point A to point B is based on ground-based nav aids, and we create these airways that are kind of like highways in the sky, but they end up being kind of zigzag, just like highways on the ground usually aren't in a perfectly straight line. And that's not a very efficient way to go. It takes longer. There's more fuel burn, so it has environmental impacts. And sometimes it routes aircraft over communities where noise and other things become an issue. So now in modern society, we have GPS and we have satellite-based technology. So we have the technology for aircraft to go in a straight line from point A to point B. But changing an entire system from an old way of doing things to a new way of doing things is a big challenge. And so that I think that the navigation aviation example is probably the best way to understand sustainability, because it makes sense across the board that it makes more money because it takes less time to get there. It's saving fuel burn, so it helps the environment, and it's potentially saving special parts of the community from having implications from noise from flying aircraft overhead.
Okay, so essentially it's bringing that consideration, that the sustainability element into the decision-making process, whereas prior, like you said, the lines that the airplanes would follow was sort of based on, well, that's the best we can do right now, but now we can do more, so let's look at it, considering that. So on that point, do you have any, one area that's of interest to me, I know very little about those, is the electrification of aviation in terms of electric planes.
Oh, yes.
Are we close? Is this going to happen?
I think it's been theoretically shown to be possible.
Yes.
Whether or not, you know, they can produce enough power. Like, you need the energy. Like, the engines on aircraft are becoming increasingly efficient. So we're finding, like, even over the past 20 years, a tremendous gains in being quieter and more fuel efficient. I've seen some solar planes, but they kind of describe it, the cockpit's the size of a coffin, and the wingspan is enormous because the solar panels are on top of the wings. But it's feasible. It's possible. So it can happen. It's just about whether or not we can get it to be efficient.
Right. And still continue to sort of move people and whatnot.
Yeah.
So do you still fly now?
Like, no, I haven't since I was pregnant with my daughter. So it's been a dozen years or so.
Okay. A couple of years. Did you miss that?
It was interesting. So when my sort of world shifted, so when I decided that being an airline pilot isn't maybe the best thing I can do, then it really pushed me into looking at other options and different things, and my passion shifted as well. So I think what you'll find, people ask me that a lot, especially because there's this big pilot shortage now, and they think, well, you know, there's a lot of opportunity for jobs. Is that something you're interested in? And I always say the same thing, in that I really feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right.
Like, I love teaching. I love the opportunity to be able to work with these young people and guide them, and working with things like safety and human factors, and it really does change the way you think about error and risk, and being able to be in that role to help them. I feel like that's my passion now.
Right. And certainly, the argument could be made that you're doing more to help alleviate any shortage by reaching a bunch of potential people and encouraging them to kind of grow and succeed in the field than you could do by flying one plane.
Well, right? I hope so.
Yeah. And now, one thing you mentioned that I thought was interesting, because I've seen it with the trucking industry, is you mentioned, you know, it's a lifestyle, being an airline pilot, commercial airline pilot in particular. But one thing I've noticed with land-based transportation, with long-haul trucking, is for the same thing. Some people, they like the driving part. They don't like the part that they're never home, or they're always in different spots. So I've noticed industry shift in that there's a lot of, and I don't remember, there's an industry term that escapes me, but basically you're home every night. So you are still driving long haul, but in such a way that you end up back where you started. And, you know, with the advances in logistics and being able to track stuff, it's feasible. Does that exist for pilots today more so, or is it still, I guess, what one would think is the typical lifestyle that you're home one day a week and you're across the world the rest of the time?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand there's a lot of variability in what it means to be a pilot. So general aviation, which is generally smaller aircraft. So general aviation pilots, being a flight instructor, working at a small sort of community-based airport, those people are generally home every night, and they have a very predictable schedule. So that's an opportunity if scheduling is more important. There's also business and corporate aviation, so flying private jets. On a side note, the CBAA, the Canadian Business Aviation Association, they're having their annual conference in Waterloo in a month, so we're going to have all of Canada's business aviation community here locally. So.
Oh, okay. Well, tell us about that. When and where?
It's June, I believe, 12th to the 14th. I don't have my calendar in front of me, but I'm pretty sure that's correct. And if people are interested, you can do a Google search for CBAA, And it's just a really neat thing that all of these leaders in all of Canada are going to be.
But it's not a public event.
Well, I think...
Or are there public pieces to it?
There is one opening for young people. So I think on one day they're opening up the exhibit hall for youth who are interested in aviation to come and learn about what it means to be a business aviation professional. So hopefully that's on
June 12th to 14th?
Yes.
Yes, Canadian Business Aviation Association.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's good. That's certainly something we'd like to encourage folks, like you said, young people in particular. Mm-hmm. So they should go to, Google's CBAA, so June 12th, 14th. Mm-hmm. That's in Waterloo, and there's a part of it that's available for young people to come out and find out about.
Yep.
The industry, so that's great. So is that piece bigger, like the you mentioned corporate and private, and maybe just off the top of my head anyways, when I think of a commercial airline pilot, I think of in Canada, Air Canada, WestJet, the guy or the gal that's in front of that plane, and boom, that's it. Is that a big piece of our industry or a small piece of our industry?
So I think like business aviation usually gets grouped into general aviation with a smaller aircraft and everything. But so there are more planes and pilots in general aviation than there are in the airlines.
Okay.
So I think that's really important because people tend to see commercial airlines and assume that that's where everybody is. But there's actually a huge community.
A much bigger one than they are. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that is key because there's probably a lot more stability, I would say, in those other parts where you're not necessarily at the whims of one large company or one industry that can have issues.
Well, going back to your previous question about, there is ways to control your schedule as an airline pilot. So so there's something called relative seniority. So pilots are based on a seniority system. So when you're hired as a pilot, you get a seniority number, which would be at the lowest. Then as you become more senior and other people retire and are hired underneath you, then your seniority number increases. And so the way it generally works is on an aircraft-by-aircraft basis. So you start as a first officer on a small aircraft. And then as you're there for a period of time and your seniority number increases, eventually you'll be a senior first officer. So you'll have a high seniority number. And at that point, you have a few options. So if you have a desire to be home every night and you really want control over your schedule, you can stay as a first officer. And then you have complete control over your bidding each month. So you can choose the routes that are most desirable that get you home. Mm-hmm. But first officers on smaller aircraft make less money than captains or first officers on bigger aircraft.
Gotcha.
So the other thing you can do is you can choose to upgrade to captain and make captain pay, but then have less control because you'll be a junior captain in those captain ranks.
Okay.
Or you can choose to upgrade to a bigger aircraft, but again, you're probably then a low seniority number again. So you're sort of sacrificing, your income versus your schedule. And at some times in your life, like if you have a young family, it probably makes sense to maybe give up a little bit of the salary to have schedule control, but maybe other parts of your life, not so much, and you're going to climb the ranks as quick as you can.
Yeah, neat. Now you brought one of the books, and that was one of the other titles here, I forgot to read. Multi-published author. and so is this your most current?
Yes. This one came out in March, so it's very...
Fundamentals of International Aviation.
Yes.
And this is am I going to use the right word, textbook?
Yes.
Phew, okay.
Yeah.
So which you use in your class?
I will in September.
Okay.
I've taught the course twice without the textbook, so I'm really excited to have the book. It's going to make my life a lot easier than trying to do it without the book.
That's pretty exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe tell us a bit more about that course. That's the fundamentals, but I want to also hear about more about the human factors.
Sure.
I think that's a piece that not everybody necessarily realizes is there, although it's critical, right?
Yeah, so I think the origin from this book came from 2 or 3 years ago. So I actually have a volunteer position on a branch of the United Nations that oversees aviation. So it's called the International Civil Aviation Organization.
Mm-hmm.
And they function like a branch of the UN. So they have representatives from 192 countries and they vote on major issues. And I think what's important to understand is that you need international cooperation for aviation to work. Because
sure.
You can't just have everybody making up their own rules. Like it would be a nightmare. there. So ICAO at their assembly a few years ago, they mandated that attracting, recruiting, and educating the next generation of aviation professionals is a global priority.
Okay.
And this being that I think people are probably generally aware of the pilot shortage, and that it's not just pilots, it's maintenance professionals and everybody in between. But aviation is growing tremendously, to the point where they expect that by 2036 that the industry is basically going to double. So we're talking twice as many aircraft, twice as many passengers, twice as many flights per day.
Wow.
And we need more than 600,000 new pilots, which I was just crunching the numbers the other day. It equates to 67 new pilots every day between now and 2036.
Wow.
And so it's this real critical time in the industry where, yeah, I think for a long time aviation, we weren't having any shortages. And I think a lot of people sort of perceive it as kind of a closed door kind of an industry. And mm-hmm. so I think we're really working hard to do the opposite, to sort of throw the doors open and say, come consider aviation careers. We have so many opportunities. You don't have to be a pilot. You don't have to be a maintenance engineer. I always say anything you can do in aviation.
Right.
We need aviation lawyers and we need aviation accountants and you know everything you can imagine mm-hmm. in between.
Mm-hmm.
And so in sitting on this committee, what I kept hearing people say was the idea that aviation education is very narrow. So we teach pilots about being pilots. We teach maintenance professionals about being maintenance professionals.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't cross over. So generally what would happen, they kind of like perceive it as narrow and then it gets bigger over time. So you start and you sort of learn to become a competent pilot as a professional. And then when you're working as a pilot, you kind of generally understand that being a pilot is a little different in other countries, but also how all the other professionals work that support the industry as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why that's a problem is because in piloting programs, it's not unusual to have a 50% attrition rate. So
wow.
half the people who start don't finish.
Okay.
And I work with these young people all the time and they're passionate and they love aviation and you know their heart is in this. And when they're not successful, they have a hard time understanding that they can do something else in aviation. And I think
okay.
I'm an example of that, that I'm not, mm-hmm. I didn't expect to be a professor when I was 16 flying helicopters, but I love what I do and I support the industry that I'm passionate about
mm-hmm.
and that there's lots of those sort of ground-based jobs. So the idea came to me for the book was, well, what if we take that perspective and we flip it upside down? That instead of introducing people to one profession in one country, what if their first taste of aviation is kind of like a really broad perspective of how all the different professionals professional groups work on an international scale,
mm-hmm.
and then it would allow them to sort of follow their passions and follow their interests, because a lot of these professional groups, people don't understand. You may know about piloting, maybe, or traffic control,
mm-hmm.
but beyond that, like you may not know what other opportunities that there are. So I tried to create a book that's almost an aviation degree in a book. So it's kind
of
it's an introduction to all the sections. So the first half of the book covers professional groups, so it's regulators, everybody who works with the design and building and maintenance of aircraft,
mm-hmm.
Operations, which is both general aviation, corporate, airlines, and all the professionals in those sectors, navigation, so the entire air traffic control sector, and airports. So a lot of people work in airports. There's a lot of really neat jobs in airports that people don't intuitively think about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the second half of the book is all these sort of professional challenges. And so these are all areas people could pursue professionally as well. So there's security. So there's a lot of professional interest in maintaining security in aviation. The environment, which is both the weather services, everybody gathers weather data. And that's another side note too. You think about how remarkable it is that on a global scale, the global community can work to collaborate to share weather data. Because aviation wouldn't work if we left Toronto and we didn't know what it was going to be like
right.
on the other side of the world. I think that's remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also the environmental impact. So planes have a history of noise issues and pollution. And so looking at that perspective as well. Then there's accidents. So how search and rescue works, what causes most aviation accidents and laying it out. Then there's human factors and safety, which you've sort of spoken about already.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last chapter is on drones, which is increasingly going to be an impact.
Mm-hmm. So that falls squarely into the aviation world.
And yeah.
By drones, when I think of a drone, I'm thinking of the toy
mm-hmm.
that kids can fly maybe 100 feet and it's around their house. But the industry is actually way beyond that. Like
yeah.
Are there drones flying today in Canada somewhere in a other than somebody playing in a park?
Yeah. So drones, the history of them used professionally is stronger on the military side. So if you go back to World War II, like there were drones at that point that they would, basically launch something in a direction, usually to distract the enemy, and then they would follow up with manned aircraft. But the international term they use is remotely piloted aircraft. Okay. And so when you look at it from that perspective, there's been all sorts of examples of like full passenger aircraft where they've made a scale model and then they've made it remotely piloted so they could crash it and test crashworthiness.
Okay.
And the military, like the drones range in size from something that, you know, fits on your tabletop to something that's the size of a traditional passenger carrying aircraft.
Like a jumbo jet. Or close to.
Yeah, because not jumbo jet, because they're not used, I think, operationally to carry people or cargo yet.
Okay.
But they could. So the technology is there. So basically, when you think about it from that perspective, it's less about a person with like a handheld controller and more about what they call a remote pilot station. So it's like a ground-based remote pilot station where pilots are on the ground, but they're operating an aircraft that's in the air.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess when you think of it from that perspective, what I'm hearing is the technology exists today to really port the entire cockpit to wherever. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing that requires the person to be there other than, say, at this point, our comfort or desire to believe that that's possible.
Yeah.
To say, okay, I'm your captain, and I'm still at the airport, and I'm like, what? No, come back. But from an actual practical, if we put humans aside for a moment, the technology's there, but the regulations and confidence is maybe coming behind for people on the plane. But other than that, now what about the one, and I don't want to go too much into a segue, but it's, I'm sure something people think about when they hear drones is, the other example that I keep reading about is Amazon wanting to use them to deliver packages. Mm-hmm. And of course, then it gets into this whole side discussion. But is that a reality in terms of, I guess, package delivery in Canada?
Yes.
And is that something that's going to fall squarely into an aviation issue, or is it going to go somewhere else?
I think what you have is a traditional aviation system that's been around for 100 years, and we're trying to manage disruptive technology. So I think like a lot of industries where new things come on board and they disrupt everything of how it's traditionally been. And so that's what my chapter tried to do, is try to say, like, if you're a traditional aviation person, this is the impact that these drones could potentially have. And there's a lot of civilian uses. So there's remotely piloted aircraft, but there's also autonomous aircraft, which are like self-flying planes, basically. And a lot of even handheld drones have some features of this built in, so that if the communication link, they call it a C2 link, so the link between the control device and the drone, if that gets severed, most drones will have a return to home function, so they'll just fly back to where they started.
Okay.
Or they'll go to a loiter point, which is like they'll go fly in a small circle somewhere until the connection's reestablished. So I think what I'm saying is that when you think about remote pilot delivery and Amazon and using drones for that purpose, that is probably going to be a hybrid of different technologies. It's probably going to be some autonomous operations, because the way I would envision that working, probably there's not a remote pilot that's flying each one of those, that it's using technology to get from point A to point B. And that's quite different from the larger drones, where you look at ones that are as big as traditional aircraft and they're flying in the airspace with piloted aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sort of having to manage regulations and communication over the radio and all sorts of issues. So could we get there? You know, who knows? Predicting the future is a hard thing to do.
Sure.
But I think that the technology is leaning towards making it possible.
Wow. Yeah, I'm very curious to see what that'll look like in a few years. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know one area that you're extremely passionate about, and in fact, one could certainly state that you were a trailblazer in yourself, is advancing women in the field of aviation. And I've heard you say it before, just from a purely practical perspective, there's a pilot shortage. So let's have the largest possible audience. But I wonder if you want to speak more to that in terms of the role, the changing roles with society today, and how that's impacted you and where you see things going.
Absolutely. So in the history of my experience being a pilot, For the most part, being a woman was an advantage, because if there's a room of 30 people and there's only one girl in the room, and if you're working hard and doing the best you can, then you're probably going to be remembered, mm-hmm. right? And so I think that for a lot of my, you know, my academic upbringing, I think it helped me. I think it gave me more visibility. But I also had some experiences when I was jump seating where I wasn't treated in the way I think a man would be treated in the same mm-hmm. situation. And I don't want to get into it too much, because I hope that that's not something that still exists, because that's quite a few years ago now. It's probably 15 years ago. So there was some, there's some bias, you know, some comments and things that are, make it uncomfortable. And so hopefully that's not something that is happening as much in modern aviation, because there's such a push now to support women joining the industry. If there's women out there who are interested, you can look at things like Women in Aviation. So if you do that search, there's an international nonprofit organization that supports women. They have a lot of scholarships to help women get their flight education. Mm-hmm. But on a global scale, there's only about 3% of airline pilots that are women. And in Canada, if you look at all the pilot license holders, so not just the ones working at airlines, but some who fly for fun and different things, we're looking at about 7%. So okay. it's still a really small percentage mm-hmm. of women in the industry. And actually, just a few weeks ago, I saw ICAO, which is that branch of the United Nations,
right.
that they've called for a conference, and I think it's going to be held in Africa, and they put a number on it, and they set a 50-50 goal for aviation to be 50-50 men and women. And there's a year on it, but I don't recall off the top of my head whether it was 2030 or whatever. But I think what was striking to me is that for many years we've talked about we need to support women, and we do. We need to make them feel comfortable and welcome that this is an industry they can be a part of. But I've never seen them actually put a number on it. Like mm-hmm. that it's almost that it's achievable, that it's possible
Absolutely,
to reach that
yeah.
50-50 yeah. goal. And you're right. Like I say all the time, that if we didn't have this gender imbalance and we wouldn't have a pilot shortage, that if you're only marketing to half the people in the world, then
it's yeah. And I think, you know, what people I think sometimes fail to realize is it's not enough to just, you know, at some point maybe society or the industry said, oh, you know what? Yeah, I guess women could do this too. That's not even a beginning. That's just a statement. That doesn't change anything. And mm-hmm. If you look at an industry, like you said, it sounds like Canada is more progressive, mm-hmm. but we're taking dismal numbers against even more dismal numbers. But if we're 93% of one gender in an industry, to expect the other gender to just go for it mm-hmm. without any support or any appreciation of how that might be a challenge, I think that's a little disingenuous. So I think it's great that you're willing to, you know, bring attention to it and do something about it, right? And a big piece is awareness is
yeah.
the industry wants mm-hmm. you know, people of all genders. You're proof yourself that, you know, it can be done. Not that we need proof, because it should be self-evident, but the reality is, again, if you've got such an imbalance, it's not going to just rebalance itself. We tend to, you know, people always tend to go with what they're familiar with, and not everybody is necessarily comfortable with being the only gender with mm-hmm. 93% of the other gender. Some people aren't, some people aren't.
I do, if you don't mind. I do think it's
sure,
helpful
please.
To shout out that the Waterloo Wellington Flight Center, that last weekend they had their Girls Can Fly event again, and I think that's such a remarkable thing. So I attended, two of my kids were able to come, my daughter and my youngest son, and seeing so many female pilots in their uniforms out there, you know, supporting young girls, like it struck me emotionally. Like it was, it's a remarkable thing, and that they're willing to give free flights to get young women up. So just, again, a shout out if anybody's interested. Next year, again, you can sign up. The tickets go fast, but it's a tremendous opportunity to get the chance to go out there. And so they give free flights to women, I think, between the age of 8 and 18. And so that's, I think, it's just a really, really striking thing for myself, because, you know, when you go there, there's more female pilots probably than there are men. And it's just a nice feeling.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it'll give me a chance to plug next week's show, but also before I do that, well, I'll just go through that. So next week on the show, Jody Scarrow is going to be
great.
My guest. And Jody is one of your students.
Yes.
And but she launched the local chapter of Women in Aviation at the Waterloo Flight Center a few months ago. Has it been? It's been a few months now.
I think early March.
Yeah. Do you now? And that event, I attended that, and I can appreciate it was similar probably for you that night that there was a predominance of women pilots, young women pilots that were there, and it creates this normalcy, which is really the point, right? Like, who knows what will happen, but I had my two daughters and one of their friends were there. So there's three young girls, and they came because Dad told them that they were coming, and they willingly volunteered to come along. But one of my youngest, who was 12 at the time, said, yeah, okay, I'm going to be a pilot because her sister's going to be prime minister, so she'll be her personal pilot. And, you know, kids, you know, pick careers when they're young and change them and follow them and do all kinds of things. But to me, what strikes me is just the normalcy of it. It's like, yeah, I could do that. I might not. I might do this. I might do that.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, that's the point to me, right? That to me says what you're doing is wonderful, and you know it, what Jody's doing is, you know, taking it to another level, and it is creating that. So it's great. I think that's probably the best. It's one of those cases where I can really understand what I've heard other people often say, that, you know, the day this isn't something we talk about will be, you know, when we get there.
Yeah.
And this is about the best I can understand of it, to say, yeah, I, you know, in some ways I can't understand what you're saying, because every time I look, I see more women pilots, but, you know, they're not when I go into an airplane.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be honest, as a flyer and as an old guy, I remember every time I hear a female captain, I'm happy, but it sticks out. When it's a guy, it kind of, quite frankly, scares me, because I think they're always, I just have a vision of a really old man with gray hair and very stern, and anyways, that's too much watching Airplane movie. So that's a whole other issue. But yeah, so that's next Saturday, or what am I saying, next Friday show. Jody Scarrow will be here, so we'll have a chance to talk some more.
Okay.
Women in aviation. What I want to get back to is, so in terms of your class though, the folks you teach, do we have more of a gender balance there in terms of the students coming in?
We do. So I don't know if universities are seen as more welcoming. I don't know if women feel more comfortable pursuing aviation in a university setting than going to a school. But we'll get between 21% to 30% women. And it kind of depends on the class. So some classes are more, some classes are less. This past semester I had a safety class, which was an elective. So it was a new class that they had to sort of really fit it in their schedule. So to be real strategic.
Now, just to be clear, you're telling me safety is elective as a class?
It's an academic exploration of how safety is managed on a global scale.
Okay.
That makes sense. So being safe is not optional, but studying it and writing papers about it and doing projects about it, that is, it's going to be required next year.
Okay.
But that class had 13 people in it, and it was about halfway through the term, and I was talking to my husband, I'm like, there's only men in that class. So it's still part of the industry, and I think that when you're in the industry, you stop noticing after a while, because it's just sort of it feels normal. But then when you get the opposite, like my first year class that I taught in September of last year had some really passionate young women in it, and that's fun too, because there's I think a growing awareness that this is something anybody can do. But I think what really strikes me, and Jody's a great example of this, so I'm glad you're speaking to her next week, is that people get into aviation because there's a spark. You know, like I don't feel like it's other professions where like, nah, maybe I'll do this, or maybe, you know, I don't know, maybe I'll do that. Like something gets ignited inside of them and they love it, and it becomes a hobby and a passion and something that they think about, you know, outside of school. And that's what makes them really fun to teach. And so it's nice to see that's, you know, reaching young women just as it is young men.
Mm-hmm. No, that's wonderful. And we were speaking earlier, you mentioned that during the summer months, you don't have an active course that you're teaching, but you've got tons of research you're doing, and other projects. Anything that you want to talk about there in terms of what we can expect to see from you or what you're working on?
Sure. So I'm working on a new textbook. It's on sustainable aviation. Mm-hmm. So just like the course that I'm teaching. Mm-hmm. And so that's taking up a lot of my time. So professors, as I was mentioning earlier, so they have 40% of your job is research, 40% is teaching, and that's sort of two classes in one term and two classes in another. So it's really common for professors to have one term of non-teaching where they focus on research. And then 20% of our workload generally is service. Mm-hmm. So service can be anything that gives back to the academic community or back to the industry that we work with. So a lot of my work right now has been looking at how we're supporting the next generation and how we're bringing them in and making sure we have pathways for young people who want to be pilots where they can, you know, find the resources that they need to pursue that as a career option. Mm-hmm. So that's been something I'm passionate about. So we were sharing before we came on air, I was pulling some numbers together yesterday that in 2016, all of the flight schools across Canada produced about 1,400 commercial pilots. Mm-hmm. But of those 1,400 pilots, when you factor in international students who are leaving Canada to go to other places to work, and or increasingly what we're seeing is international companies buying Canadian flight schools to serve their home markets, that only about 500 of those pilots actually join the aviation community and work as pilots here in Canada. And that about 10 years from now, we're expecting that we're going to have a shortfall somewhere between 3,000 to 7,000 pilots, depending on fatigue regulations. Mm-hmm. And so that's tremendous. Like that's something where I feel like we're standing on the train tracks and we're seeing the train coming. And, mm-hmm. and it's like, we got to start paying attention to this because we're just, it's a critical threat. And I don't think people realize how much aviation affects day-to-day life and our economy and just our general way of being. And so if you think about, you know, if it's a doubling of ticket prices or if we just can't get a flight on a given day or if your flight's canceled because they don't have crew to fly it, which is increasingly common mm-hmm. because of the pilot shortage, how much that impacts your daily life. So I'm hoping, and that's where some of my efforts have been, is to do what we can to get it out there that we need to really support and encourage young people to think of aviation careers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's... one of the things you mentioned, I think, as a consuming public of, you know, of aviation services, we tend to, I think, have fairly narrow views, mm-hmm. right? We think of maybe just airplanes to go when we go to go on vacation or to take us somewhere on business and whatnot. And of course, you know, we're paying for a service, so mm-hmm. we have these expectations. And certainly, my view. Correct me if I'm wrong, but much of the negative press or negative things that happen have a lot more to do with business practices of the companies and the management that run the companies, and very little to do with, for instance, the actual aviation piece or the pilots themselves. The pilots generally don't just sit on a tarmac for 4 hours because they feel like it. In a lot of cases, they're forced to, or they're, you know, it's they're following the company's.
Yes.
Company's rules, they're unfortunately the people that are in front of the customer. So they tend to see the brunt. But one thing you mentioned earlier on the flip side of that, which does amaze me, and I think it's something that probably we all could learn from, is how amazing all this stuff generally just happens, right? Like mm-hmm. all these at any given point in time, mm-hmm. I could be wrong, I think it's 10,000 to 12,000 planes that are in the air worldwide at a given moment. I don't know if
yeah,
that's exactly right.
I think it's... And the numbers are hard when you're off the top of my head,
sure,
but if I remember correctly, I think it's 20,000 flights per day.
Okay.
So I don't know, but given in the air and at a given time, because they often talk about by 2036, it's 40,000.
Okay. And so, I mean, all this is happening mm-hmm. and they've got to land, they've got to take off and mm-hmm. not just anywhere at an airport you know, when bad things happen, which, you know, weather is often the cause, and you'll hear it, whether it's Chicago or Toronto or big airport, literally thousands of flights mm-hmm. are canceled. When I think of that, if you think of anything else we do, if that much disruption happened, it would take months to get going again. Somehow the industry gets back up in like 2 to 3 days for the most part.
Yeah.
Of course, the individual people affected, it's the end of the world, mm-hmm. I get that. I've been there myself. But It all somehow sorts itself out relatively quickly, like considering the scope, and that is amazing. That's to do with how well it's put together, right?
Well, I like to think of it as an aviation community, because unfortunately the airlines get the brunt of the complaints, you know, mm-hmm. because that's where the passengers are intersecting with aviation. But airlines can't control if there's a slot open at the airport,
right.
or if air traffic control has grounded flights because their destination is having a major storm, or if maintenance can't get the part they need, and you know, like that maybe you could argue that is an airline issue, but the reality is, so the service and the customer service piece of it, and I always think sometimes that in a lot of ways the industry has set it up in a almost for failure, because we've created this expectation that aviation is glamorous and the flight attendants will serve you your drinks and yes. we'll take really good care of you, almost like a nice restaurant. You know, you expect service. And so we're seeing some of these ultra low cost carriers, which were saying, you know what, no, if you want to come, just get the cheapest flight. You don't expect any frills or anything extra. And we'll just get you from point A to point B. Because we're seeing even a lot of the passenger complaints that they happen disproportionately in business class than to economy class. Mm-hmm. And I always think of that as, well, there's an expectation you're going to be served. So if something happens that's outside of the control of your crew, unfortunately, the crew are the ones who get yelled at and get those complaints.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's I definitely would reiterate that those are corporate decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, those folks maybe should take heed and take some more direct responsibility, because certainly the aviation piece of it, definitely out of their control. And but it is quite amazing how despite that, you know, how relatively few things happen in the scheme of things, and how it all just kind of somehow works.
Well, right. It's funny when you bring that up. I think I was chuckling because when I'm teaching this class, my first year class, we talk about security. Mm-hmm. And my students' favorite part is the part where we talk about disruptive passengers, because there's no shortage of ridiculous behavior of passengers on aircraft. And I think even in my book, I talk about a case where a woman became heavily intoxicated and was assaulting the passenger next to her. And then when the flight attendant asked her to calm down, she unbuckled her prosthetic leg and hit the flight attendant with her prosthetic leg, and then threatened to open the door while they're flying to escape.
Okay.
And so so that's a big issue of security. So it's not just about screening the baggage and the passengers before they get to the aircraft. You know, sometimes, especially with reinforced cockpit doors, that the pilots are sort of behind these doors, and we're having flight attendants having to deal with just crazy behavior from people.
Mm-hmm.
Also because alcohol affects you more in the air because of the pressurization than it does on the ground. So people can get out of hand, but.
Yeah, and it feeds into itself, like you said, and you know, one of the features of business class mm-hmm. tends to be unlimited amounts of alcohol and probably a much greater leeway maybe from the service, because there's this expectation, I've paid this much money, therefore, you know, and you know, so it's unfortunate, but you know, at a certain point you go, well, what else did you think was going to happen here?
Yes.
Where did you think this was going to go? But anyhow. So we have a couple of minutes left. Is there anything else that you want to talk about?
Sure. Well, I can talk really quickly about human factors, if
sure.
that's helpful.
Absolutely.
So, and again, just reinforcing the idea that human factors is something we teach at the university, but human factors and safety are so ingrained in every aspect of aviation. Like, safety really is number one in aviation in every element. But what I do at the university from a human factors perspective is I say that today in aviation, 70 to 80% of accidents are primarily caused by pilot error. So there was a time, so earlier into the 50s and 60s, where the aircraft themselves were the major source of accidents. And then what they did is every accident, they would investigate what happened. And when there was a flaw in the aircraft, you can identify what that flaw is, and then you can put out an airworthiness directive and fix all the aircraft.
Right.
And so over the course of time, they were able to dramatically reduce the number of aircraft-caused accidents. But the challenge was that it was really difficult to reduce the number of human error caused accidents, so people making mistakes. And I think that's sort of just one of the hallmarks of being a human being, that it's really difficult to, even if I understand what causes somebody to make a mistake, things like texting and driving, like everybody knows that's really dangerous and it's not a smart thing to do, and yet it's really hard to get everybody to not do that. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, we're not having pilots texting and flying, but there's issues. It's generally communication, so speaking to each other effectively, being able to maintain a mental picture of your environment and all the critical threats and pieces of information in your environment. Workload management. So there's at any point in a cockpit, there's lots of different things happening, and pilots need to be able to prioritize the most important things. Mm. There was a really famous example, I believe it was in the 70s, where there was a flight and a light came on in the cockpit, which was kind of inconsequential, and the first officer accidentally bumped the control stick, and when they did that, they didn't realize they disengaged the autopilot. Okay. And so all the crew was so fixated on this light and trying to troubleshoot why this light had come on that they didn't realize they'd started a slow and unnoticed descent and eventually descended right into the Everglades in Florida. So, so it's a very preventable accident, but it's about workload management issue. So about making sure that people can prioritize and maintain focus where they need to. Decision-making is critical as well. But all of these things, like awareness, managing your workload, decision-making, they don't affect pilots more than any other professional group. It's just when a pilot has a mistake like that, it has the potential to impact the passengers and the system as a whole. So that's why we focus a lot on it. So it's a fun class to teach at the university because I was actually watching Netflix Brain Games, and it talks a lot about how your mind works and different things. And a lot of it's human factors. A lot of it is the same sort of things that we talk about at the university. So the limitations of your memory and the limitations of how many things you can pay attention to at a time before you can expect to make mistakes and get overwhelmed.
Okay. So you actively teach sort of awareness of these things, but also I'm assuming techniques or protocols to address it or minimize it, and then hopefully future doesn't happen. So in a sense, there's a good news out of the idea that 70-80% of the errors are there because we've eliminated everything else as possible causes. So, well, what else is left?
Yes.
And now we can focus basically everything there. Because I think from an accident perspective, I know for some reason what comes to mind lately was two different incidents where windows fractured on planes. Mm. But those, I don't think, they haven't figured out for sure what the issue was at this point.
You could hypothesize, but generally you'd think it would be some sort of an aircraft structural issue. That would be not part of the 70-80% of human, unless sometimes the human error is maintenance as well. So maintenance professionals can make mistakes as well.
So that would play in there too, right? Because in a sense, if there's rules to follow or sort of schedules and they're not done because somebody didn't do it or said they did and who knows what.
And then on my safety class, so safety in aviation has evolved more recently as well. So we used to have a very reactive approach to safety where we waited for an accident and then we investigated what caused it and then we'd implement fixes. So the major problem there is an accident has to happen before we're doing things and making fixes. So now what we have is a proactive approach to safety. So it's called safety management. And the way it works is all aviation companies on a regular basis will try to track elements of risk. So not big things necessarily. It could be very small things, but minor issues. And what we're trying to do is identify those risk areas and eliminate them before accidents happen. Okay. So that represents like a huge evolution in the way we manage safety. So it becomes a part of every day, a continual process of collecting areas of risks and hazards and then eliminating them before accidents happen.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. We're out of time, almost. Thank you, Suzanne. Dr. Suzanne Kearns, Associate Professor, University of Waterloo, and you're back teaching in the fall. And thank you so much for coming on. And the one more time, the association that people should look for women is?
Women in Aviation.
Women in Aviation. Yep. And once again, we'll have Jody Scarrow join us next Friday at 12:30 here on In Studio. And I want to just mention for our friends in the area, Kitchener-Waterloo, there that are into jazz, this Sunday at 3 p.m. at the Rhapsody Barrel Bar, Nick McLean is performing, and he's performing music from Herbie Hancock. And he also has one more performance the following Sunday where he's going to feature another jazz great in his performances. So that's this Sunday and next Sunday, 3 p.m. at the Rhapsody Barrel Bar. This has been In Studio with Kevin here on CKMS 102.7 FM, radiowaterloo.ca/listen. Have a great weekend. Thank you.